about my interest, and I have a major interest in getting outdoors and hiking Old Bannon Railroad right of ways. And one of my students was from Nunica, and she said, there's a guy in Nunica who has all kinds of pictures on the interurban. And so after the semester was over, I got his address and called him up on the telephone and paid him a visit. Will and Hagen sitting up here at the front table. Jack and his friend Lawrence Carlson have collected and preserved over 150 photographs of the interurban, numerous timetables and other memorabilia with respect to the interurban. And Lawrence and Jack and Art Gibson, who's going to be running the slide projector, and myself are working on a book. We're still gathering material. We've got a number of questions yet that aren't quite clear in our minds. We're looking for additional material. This summer, I was asked by, well, the first day that Molly was on the job or second day, I'm not quite sure which, Molly, I showed up. And the reason why I showed up was since I heard that you had an executive director, I wanted to make sure that executive director knew what my research interests were when she talked to all of you about what you may or may not have in terms of Michigan history in general and the Grand Haven area in particular. So I talked about my interest in logging history and mentioned the fact that Jack and Art and Lawrence and I were working on a project with respect to the interurbans, and she helped me find a few photographs at the museum and showed me all the log marks that someone had hand copied that are up in the basement of the museum and so on. And I don't know how it happened, but I somehow made the mistake of saying, well, if you're real desperate for a program, just give me a ring. Well, I didn't expect it this fast. I mean, that was hardly 2 months ago that I made the mistake of saying that. We're still collecting photographs and so on, and one advantage of having to put a program on is that you get busy. And so we met several times to try to put together a slideshow. So, now we'll begin with a discussion of the interurban, but if you've got anything on logging, let me know later on. The Grand Rapids, Grand Haven, and Muskegon Railway was organized 87 years ago in 1900 to construct an electric interurban railroad between Grand Rapids and both Grand Haven and Muskegon. It cost $1.5 million to build. It was equipped with 15 passenger cars and 3 express cars and one maintenance-away car called the Red Devil back then. During the period of time it was under construction, they also built something else that was very fascinating, I'm sure many of you remember, and that is the pavilion at Fruitport, which was built in 1901, an old Pomona pavilion. They built it, of course, to attract passengers, and they were very successful at doing so. All the cars in this interurban were electrically powered, the electricity being produced at a coal-burning power plant in Fruitport. This was prior to the time of Consumers Power. When Consumers Power came, they shifted over to them. But anyway, the electricity was generated in Fruitport, and it was transmitted to the cars by a third rail, 600 volts DC, direct current in the country. And in the cities such as Grand Haven, Spring Lake, and so on, they utilized an overhead trolley wire for very obvious reasons. One of the problems with that 600 volt low third rail is it would have fried a few people had it running down the main streets of the community. One of the people I talked to said that it was very fun to be living in the Ottawa country side during the time that this interurban ran, particularly in the summertime, because you could never be sure whether or not a storm was coming in from Lake Michigan or one of the interurbans was going by half a mile or so away because of the quite spectacular fireworks that could be generated, because whenever the interurban came to a crossing, no third rail. So it had to coast across the crossing. So the engine would be out for a short period of time and then kick back in. And when it kicked back in, you could get some very interesting sparks, depending on the weather conditions and so on. The interurban main line was built in the form of a Y. One track connected Grand Rapids with Grand Haven Junction, Grand Haven Junction being between Nunica and Fruitport. The track then split into two branches, one going to Muskegon and the other going to Spring Lake and on to Grand Haven. The Interurban ran on street railway tracks in all three of its terminal cities. It ran on the street railway tracks in Grand Rapids. It ran on the Grand Haven street railway tracks in Grand Haven. And the same is true with respect to Muskegon. That was one way of keeping its costs down considerably. The Interurban was a very popular railroad for a variety of reasons, one of which was that it ran 18 trains a day. A train, of course, needs to only be one car when you're dealing with an Interurban. It was also fast. No smoke, no soot, no cinders, and very quiet. Cars could accelerate very rapidly and stop quite fast. So it could drop you off at the street corner as opposed to, or the grade crossing out in the countryside as opposed to the steam railroads. The Grand Trunk coming from Grand Rapids to Grand Haven, for example, had a number of stations, but in between you're talking about 6-9 miles or more in many cases, whereas the Interurban could drop you right off at the grade crossing or street corner if it happened to be in town. Well, let's go back in time tonight. Sometime between 1902-03 and 1928. Let's ride the Interurban from Grand Haven to Grand Rapids, courtesy of Jack Rollenhagen and Lawrence Carlson, because they have preserved over 150 photographs, many of which you will see tonight. You won't see all of them. Art wanted to show all of them. We brought all of them. I saw two boxes there. We're only going to show 80, and we'll try to make it fairly fast. Our trip won't take as long as the Interurban did, which was a little over an hour. We'll try to keep our trip considerably under an hour. I notice Molly flinching. But our trip will include numerous flash-ups to the future, that is, the present. We'll use photographs that were taken by Art Gibson when Art and I, and on occasion Jack, searched for the archaeological remains of this Interurban during the past year. We had some very fascinated and heated discussions out in the woods and a few other locations. We were trying to figure out exactly where the Interurban went and whether or not this was a building associated with the Interurban and so on. Sit back, relax, and we'll take you on your first ride. A ride in the Interurban, the Ramona Amusement Park in East Grand Rapids. Afterwards, we'll take you... wonderful, they got a light here. I appreciate that. Afterwards, we'll take you on a trip to Fruitport, the tour of the shops, the equipment, and then on to Muskegon. If the tour is a little bit bumpy at points, blame that on the conductor. He hasn't run the trip yet. This is essentially the first showing. Okay, what we have here is a timetable labeled timetable number one, and I was confused with this timetable because it says July 1, 1903, and the first Interurban ran February 1902. Well, the Interurban didn't come into Grand Haven because the city fathers couldn't agree politically with the Interurban Railroad until 1903, and it finally got into Grand Haven in 1903, and they numbered their timetables, number one and on, from the time it entered Grand Haven. Next slide, please. This is a view. I'm going to move this a little bit because I can't see the slides very well. I'll just move over the side. Move this over this way then. Okay, here are a picture of two of the Interurban cars. One important component of the Interurban was not only going to the resorts, but also connecting up with Chicago and Milwaukee steamships. Next slide. Here's a shot that should be familiar to many of you. We're talking about being in Grand Haven. While there was a depot in Grand Haven where most of the Interurban cars stopped, occasionally Interurban cars would go all the way to Highland Park. This is the corner of Washington and Harvard. Next slide, please. There's a shot of what I think used to be the Goodrich Line Depot, is that correct? Right. And there was a track that went right adjacent it. In fact, we think a couple of tracks, one for freight and one or two for freight. We don't know enough about this in use as a passenger station, so anyone that could give us information about this later on would be appreciated. Next slide, please. We're on our way out of Grand Haven. Very fascinating bridge. Toll bridge with a turnkey. There are different kinds of ways to turn bridges. This is a very fascinating one. Also, I'm quite fascinated by the what looks like overhead steel used to convey electricity for the trolley car that's in the background. A couple of very interesting gentlemen in the foreground, and a couple of young boys in the background as we start our trip over the Grand River toward Spring Lake. Next slide, please. Here is another shot showing conductor, motorman, looks like, in the back, also going over the same bridge. This was a toll bridge. I don't know how much they charge to go over this as a vehicle or traffic or walking. I'd appreciate it if someone could help us out on that later on as well. Next slide, please. For those of you who are wondering where was this bridge over the Grand River, this was shot this summer. I'm not advertising cigarettes or the beast, but that happened to be where Art was standing when he took the photograph, so he takes the blame for the advertising. But basically, the bridge came pretty much from here over toward where the Holiday Inn is. We've got to look at it more carefully, but that's approximately where the bridge was located. Next slide, please. But all this time, we're on the trolley wire. We're using a trolley pole wire overhead for safety's sake. We're going down Savvy Street now in Spring Lake, and there is a depot in Spring Lake. It's amazing that this interurban was wealthy enough, or at least had enough money invested, to build a number of very substantial structures, many of which are still standing today, such as this one. Next. 1986. I think this was shot last year when Art and I started on this project. We've been at it for about a year. Chris, Jack, and Lawrence, I don't know how many years Jack's been at it. I think about 40 or more years with respect to this. But this is the remains of the depot, what I call the archaeology of the of the railroad, still being used today.
We'd like to know if that warehouse was on the back.
In many cases, they had a freight area, and we're interested whether that warehouse was added or whether there was another building on the back of it that was tore down in between or what.
There was an
ice house back there? So this station was a combination small freight and passenger station, probably. Okay. Well, in many cases, when we raise the questions, I appreciate the clarification you just made right now, and then we go in more detail later on afterwards when we try to get things written down in our notes. Okay, we're going down Savvy Street, going east. Now, you got to remember, the people who took these slides, or photographs, didn't take them always the direction I wanted, so the car may not be going in the appropriate direction. Please forgive us as we go on our imaginary trip down Savvy Street, east out of Spring Lake. Next slide, please. One of the things we have to do is take down the trolley pole and shift over to the third rail and take off. And in the process of taking off, the interurban went up and over the Grand Trunk Tracks by the cemetery on the east side of Spring Lake. Art and Jack and I spent a fascinating Sunday afternoon here trying to figure out what happened on one side of the track. The cemetery side was no problem, but the other side, someone had taken out all the sand. It was a quarry hole, and so we ran on that side. It took us a while to figure out. But it, anyway, now we're headed east, northeast. We're going to go behind the cemetery and across the, what is now the golf course. Next slide. And we're going to plunge into the woods. This is my younger son walking with me. This was Thanksgiving weekend last year, and we're walking between Grand Haven Junction and the golf course. I had no problems, my son keeping up, because I promised him if he got there first, he'd get a candy bar. But you can walk this. These are used as two-track vehicles and so on. Most of the area, we had no problems with following the abandoned road grade at all. It's quite easy. Next.
Right,
this is actually, see, you know, like I said, the photographs aren't always in the right direction. We're looking in a southwesterly direction back toward the golf course, as of course the car is going toward Grand Haven Junction. Next slide, please. This is Grand Haven Junction between Fruitport and Nunica, where the two legs of the Y came together with a very long leg, one short leg coming from Grand Haven, another short leg of the Y coming from Muskegon, joining together, and you could go either of two ways out of here coming from Grand Haven. You could go to Muskegon, or you could go to Grand Rapids, and since I'm from Grand Rapids, we're going to go to Grand Rapids. Next slide, please. This is a very fascinating little depot at Nunica. There are several things that are quite interesting in this, not only because it preserves a particular period of time and history in terms of the style of clothing and various equipment, but you can notice the third rail quite clearly here. And you notice the third rail ends. This is one of those gaps. There's the third rail. It ends by a cattle guard. They had heavy fencing wherever they had the third rail. And so when it came to a crossing or a small station, there would be this gap in the third rail, and there would be these cattle guards to try to keep people and animals out and away from the very hot third rail. So this is a very fascinating photograph of Nunica in the 1920s or maybe even 1910s. Next slide, please. Another shot of this station in the distance. You see this house. Take a real close look at that house. The house is still there. Notice the very interesting crossing signal as well, and the planks down there on a dirt road. It's no longer a dirt road. It's a nice paved county road running north-south. The tracks are running east-west at this point in time. And the roadbed is still there. When you drive there, Nunica, you can see the roadbed. Next slide. There it is. That house is still there, and that nice sloping, you know, is not someone's ex-driveway, but rather the old inner urban right-of-way. Next slide, please. On to Coopersville. It's very easy to ascertain this is Coopersville, because Coopersville was one of the two locations to have very, very high substation. Notice how tall that building is in the background. They ran wires into the top, and they had generators in there. This is one of the substations for maintaining the 600 volts direct current in the line. So they had a freight station, a combination freight station, passenger station, and sub-power line station there. And then these interesting steps on this side as well. Coopersville, probably, again, teens or the 1920s, advertising something on the front of that car. We'll have to try to look at it more carefully. It seems to me it says Majestic Theater, but I'm not sure. Okay, and is this the first time I've ever seen them blown up like this? So I see some detail I've never seen before. We've been showing them on my kitchen wall, which is not the best in the world, as I was complained enough times to me. Car number 7. The Spring Lake is not the name of the car. They did not name their cars. Many of these cars have Spring Lake, Mona Lake, and so on, in several locations. The cars were all numbered. Next slide. This is a shot that someone took when it was still in operation. Notice the wiring and so on with respect to this little depot. When it went through Coopersville, it went back to the trolley wire. That's why you see the wire up above. And they sure let the ivy grow then, didn't they? Phenomenal. I don't think that the New Historical Society would do that to you. As a biologist, I wouldn't mind, but as a historian, I'd like to be able to see the building. It's possible that the tracks are still in place and the wires are still up. But it may very well have been in 1928-29 when the railroad ended. Next slide. The power is where they brought in high power lines, and in there they had generators and converters to bring it down to 600 volts to direct current. That's the reason for the power. They had two of these major substations. One here at Coopersville, and that's still there. Next slide. There it is. That's where we're going to have the signing take place for October the 1st. Isn't that right? And it's a nice, interesting building. Art and I are going to look forward to getting into it, because when we were there, it was closed and we couldn't get inside. But that building is still in existence, and there are two buildings like that. There's this one, and you'll see another one a little later on. This is on Main Street, Coopersville. Yes.
Think about the architecture of those buildings,
that
was typical for a
railroad station. Not all that typical, not that I'm aware of, but I'm not that much of an expert with respect to interurbans. I've looked at a few interurban books and so on, but it's unusual to have two of these kinds of stations on the line, at least that I'm aware of. But I can't answer your question as an authority who's studied other interurbans that carefully. I just haven't noticed them before. But one of the advantages of studying an interurban is as you become more familiar, then you say, you ask the question that you just asked, and that is, what about others? And when I look at interurban books in the future, I guarantee you I'm going to be looking at them differently after having studied our interurban. Okay, next slide. On and out of town, going east toward Berlin, Marne. One advantage of the interurban, what did I tell you? It could stop at any what? Any grade crossing. And it did. Not all these grade crossings were on the timetable. This one certainly isn't on the timetable, but Art and I fell in love with this one. This one is right adjacent to I-96. It's at this point that the interurban track, the abandoned right-of-way comes in real close back to the follows those right where we are. We shot the photograph basically from where the old interurban right-of-way crossed the road. This is Titusville. There isn't much at Titusville. And if you don't believe me, next slide. Titusville, population 3 people, 1 dog. That may have been one of the problems with the interurban, I don't know. But we fell in love with Titusville simply because someone had a good sense of humor. Now, the interurban from this point on travels along side of I-96. For quite a distance, all you have to do is look where the power lines are. And that's where the interurban is running, on the north side of I-96. And then we come to the high bridge. You see the grade going up, and it will now go south, up over the Grand Trunk tracks, which of course no longer being there, and then come down I-96, go on the other side, on the south side of I-96. And if you're wondering where this is, and if you know something about an interesting mural on a barn, advertising the Silo Gopher, I think is what it advertises. Well, when you see that sign, just look directly across the other side, on the north side, and that's where I'm standing. Basically, almost directly north of that barn that has that mural on it. And that is where the interurban went up and over the Grand Trunk tracks. Of course, the Grand Trunk being a competitor with the interurban. The interurban won out. In the short run, the Grand Trunk stayed around a little longer, but the interurban got the traffic. because they provided some extra amenities that the Grand Trunk couldn't at that time. Next slide. Berlin, not Germany, Berlin, Michigan. And for some of you know only too well, Berlin became a different town during World War I because of the very strong anti-German prejudice because of what was happening in the war. The first station there was Wooden. We've got car number 12 going through. Again, you notice there's no third rail right here. There's a gap in it. And that creates some problems for the third rail ending right there. It's a great crossing where we are. It's not present. Again, I find the clothing style fascinating. There's a lot of history here. Very fascinating history. Local history. A local history that needs to be recorded more permanently. Next slide. Later, there was a second station. I think the first one burned down. Am I correct on that? I think the first one burned down, Jack. A second, more substantial station was built, brick. This station still exists today. Next slide. Right, now a restaurant. And this is last fall, while they were working on the restaurant, we poked our noses not only in the building, but down in the cistern, where a couple pieces of metal had been placed, and we were trying to ascertain what they were. So we're in the process of looking down there. And Art gets to take all the pictures. See, I get to be in them. He gets to take them. We may change that in the future. I think Art's going to probably want to change that. But we have a lot of fun. A lot of fun getting out and doing things. My wife isn't so happy about it because, you know, you're going with Art again. But anyway, we have fun together. Okay, next slide. Another view of it. There was a Lions community building up until last fall, and it is now an interesting restaurant. And I like to see some of the inner urban preserved and used, and we have the building in Spring Lake that's being used, and this one is very public in the sense that you can buy coffee, pie, nice breakfast, and what have you. Okay, next slide. This is a slide of the front of the second substation in Walker. Remembrance Road is built on the old interurban right-of-way. That's why all of a sudden the road goes from Leonard to branch off Remembrance Road is because the interurban was coming in from Berlin Marne. Well, partway down Remembrance Road heading east beyond the West Beltline, beyond the Walker City Hall, there is this building still standing. Next slide. It is now an animal clinic. Notice the high tower again. Coopersville and Walker are the only two that have the high tower. The rest of the building has been modified a lot more. That's very fascinating again. We do have the a diagram of the interior of these high towers, but I don't know how common they were on other urban lines. Next slide. Okay, so they may have been more common than I'm aware of. Okay, we're going down Leonard Street. We've gone off from what now is Remembrance Road onto Leonard Street, and we're shifting over from the third rail to the Grand Rapids streetcar line track. And this is at the corner, it's hard to believe, because I know where this spot is, and boy, this doesn't look good. But this is Leonard Street by Walker, just before you come to the cemetery on Leonard Street Hill. That little dip down where the Myers store used to be. Myers would be almost across the way in the empty field. Very fascinating. That area. There was a Y here so they could turn around a car. But they went onto the Grand Rapids streetcar tracks, shifting over. You can see the trolley pole already up and onto the trolley wire, and this one is going in the right direction. This got us going into Grand Rapids. Okay, next slide. This ran right on the Grand Rapids streetcar tracks. this is an interesting shot, not only because of the very fast and mean truck, and remember the automobiles ultimately destroy the interurban, but we get a little comparison with a streetcar as well. Unfortunately, the person who shot this was more interested in the truck, I think, than in the streetcar. We would have loved to have had a shot of the interurban and the streetcar to make a nice comparison. But if you look, you can get enough of an idea. One, notice how low the streetcar is compared to the interurban. The interurban is high, very high up. Had to have a much more powerful engine to go long distances and so on. Much more powerful, and stood up quite high compared to the much smaller, lighter, and slower streetcar. Now, this is Ottawa, if I remember correctly. We figured out Ottawa by the Waters building. To the best of our knowledge, there is no evidence that this interurban ever went in to where the interurban station for the Holland interurban and the Kalamazoo interurban. It went strictly on a loop around the downtown area on the streetcar tracks and came right back out. And would go out on Leonard Street. Okay, we've gotten you downtown, but we want to go a little further. We want to have some fun. So we'll go on to Ramona Park. And the interurban did go all the way to Ramona Park on special occasions. You could make arrangements to have your own excursion car with a group and go all the way to Ramona Park, just as people in Grand Rapids could do the same thing if they wanted to go to Highland Park here in Grand Haven. Any questions at this point, in addition to those comments and so on that have already been made? Well, then let's go on another trip. Now we're going to go out of Grand Rapids, and we're going to go through Shreveport and Muskegon. Okay, next slide. And we're going to take a group this time, more than just ourselves, on our way. Next slide. Notice that, by the way, they had a car labeled 13. I give them credit. I stay in many hotels on the 14th floor. Ha, ha. I know what floor I'm on. It doesn't bother me. I give that interurban a lot of credit for dealing with those superstitious ideas. Okay, what is this building? Great for a photograph, but we don't have much. Does the next slide show a little better? If I remember correctly. This, we think, is Arnie's. Some of you know Arnie's what? Now, this one we know is Arnie's. The other one was the one we think is Arnie's. Arnie's Restaurant in Grand Rapids. Leonard Street was the freight depot for the interurban. Again, another building preserved with respect to the interurban. Okay, next slide. That says Arnie's looks today. On our way back out, we're going to go through by the old Berlin station, so this is prior to World War I. Going on, next slide. One of the problems of the interurban and the Grand Trunk space is water. And water eroded away bridges and everything else. In the past, the Grand Trunk Bridge was washed out completely. I don't know, Jack, was the interurban bridge ever washed out? Okay, but this is over Crockford Creek, just east of Nunica. Very, very high water. Right adjacent it would be the Grand Trunk. This is shot from the Grand Trunk tracks looking down at it. Next slide. Okay, this is taken last winter when Jack and Art and I were out hiking. This is where the interurban crossed, where the bridge was gone. We're looking back at the Grand Trunk Bridge, which is still there. The Grand Trunk Line, of course, having been abandoned, unfortunately. I someday hope to see that back in operation, but maybe not in my lifetime, unfortunately. I won't get onto that story. We'll stick with this one. We like to do archaeology. I like to do landscape ecology, and it's fun being outside. It really is. And finding the remains of an interurban. Next slide. Again, we're at Grand Haven Junction, but for some reason, we're going to pass by the Sand Hill City, and we're going to go to the Sawdust Capitol. Okay, next Why? Oops, Art, what did you do to me? You took me to the Sand Hill City. Okay, this is a one of the maintenance cars going along toward Island Park area in terms of Grand Haven. We're going to make this one a fast trip, Art. So, next slide. Now, he's got us on a swamp now. You may not recognize this, and I know I certainly wouldn't if I hadn't been there. This is looking across the bayou directly east of the old U.S. 16 by Fruitport. If you, as you cross the little bridge by Fruitport on the old 16, you will see a gap in the stream, in the bayou, a small gap. And that's because they filled in both sides for the interurban. This is where there was an interurban bridge. Unfortunately, we don't have a slide of the interurban bridge, or we would put it in here. Next slide. Now, that's the scene some of you certainly can recognize from either having seen it in person, or maybe more likely having seen photographs and listening to other people talk about it, which has certainly been my case. This is that Fruitport, and this is the station associated with a pavilion. This shot was taken from the pavilion, shot at the station. You see more than one car there and lots of people. The pavilion was one of the most popular places on the interurban route. Next slide. There's the shot. See the tracks in the foreground, and in the background, you see the beautiful pavilion with the flags flying. Some one of you may have a postcard I'd like to get a copy of. A postcard that's done of the pavilion at night, and with artist work, handwork, touching it up so that it looks all lighted up and so on. Very attractive. We'd like to get a color slide made of that for our presentation and for our book. Notice the steamboat in the background and the people walking around. This is a very, very important part of their leisure time in the past. Next slide. Not much there today. Burned down, when was it? 1963 or thereabouts? I'm trying to remember. Somewhere around that time, the pavilion burned down. 61, 63, somewhere in that period of time it burned down. All that are left are the pilings. But those pilings give us a little piece of history yet. Maybe for another 10, 20 years, or unless someone does something in that area, they could be gone in a couple of weeks. Next slide. Going on to Muskegon Heights. In Muskegon Heights, you shift from the third rail back down to the trolley, and for some reason they had a powerhouse, a substation, but it was a very low one. It didn't have that nice tall tower that we had at Walker or at Coopersville. This shot was taken just a couple weeks ago, wasn't it, Art? We didn't even know about it until about a month ago, and I think Lawrence Carlson told us about it, and then we went in there and took a photograph, or actually took a photograph of it. This is in Muskegon Heights. Going on? Okay, this is at the station in Muskegon, which is across from that nice brick station, or stone station, right along the lakefront. This would be on the other side of the street. Right, the best of our knowledge, that's where it fits. Next slide. This is a panoramic view of the station. As best we can ascertain, the only place it makes sense is in Muskegon. We're puzzled by why there's so much sand. I know there's a lot of sand in Muskegon, too, but I thought the boiler works might have been there by this time, and so we're going to have to go through some old deeds and so on and buildings and try to figure out when it was. They couldn't have snow piled that high behind there. I'd really be impressed with Muskegon, even more so than the Kenai Peninsula in terms of snow.
Well, that's lower.
Right. This is the lower part, and there is a hill back there. But I'm wondering why the boiler works is in between. But anyway, if someone knows anything about this and can give us some more information. Lawrence Carlson has given us some information, but I don't think he's seen this photograph yet. We haven't talked with him about it. We just got this from, I believe, wasn't it at the Tri-Cities Historical Museum right here just a couple of weeks ago. So we're still finding photographs with respect to the inner urban. Okay, we've gotten through Muskegon. Next slide. Well, we've got another one of the freight houses in Muskegon. Art kind of likes freight houses. Next slide. Another view. Again, with the workmen up on the top. And you can see some of the buildings now. Some of which I think are still standing in Muskegon. One could, if you get yourself in this position, put it in perspective. Next slide. Now, this is what we think is the only remaining building in Muskegon proper. But it's been reworked quite a bit. It's lost a lot of its beauty. Next slide. Well, this inner urban had a fascinating system of operation. All the cars were telephone dispatched. Every conductor had his own telephone. And when he would come to a station, or in some cases to a grade crossing, he could get out and patch himself in and get then the headquarters to dispatch from that point. Whether if he was concerned, he could be held up there or what have you. But notice the switchboard and the calendar, I believe, says 1919 in the background. Okay, that's how they operated using this. This is a very key part of their operation. However, there were some failures, as you'll see shortly. Next slide. Fantastic shot of the car barns in Fruitport. The headquarters was in Fruitport. Fruitport had the headquarters, had the car barns, had the power station, and had the pavilion. So they got quite a bit with respect to the inner urban. That's a fantastic shot showing many of their cars, and notice the traffic coming out of it with respect to this car barn. Very attractive building. Next slide. Still in existence. This is right along the northern end of Spring Lake, right by Fruitport, to the west of the park, or southwest of the park. Next slide. They had work to do, and they had to work with those motors to keep them going. And this was a full-fledged machine shop. They could do electrical repairs as well as other repairs here. Next slide. If I'm going too fast, let me know. This is the first time I've gone through this. They had a lot of equipment for working on these cars. They rebuilt cars for very good reason, as you'll see shortly. They had no choice. Either that or scrap them. They had quite an elaborate repair shop. Next slide. They had problems with the main line. Main line was built in Michigan. Michigan has sinkholes. They built some of the track through what? Swampy areas. And guess what happened to some of the track? It sunk. And so they used this pile driver to push the track back up and to strengthen the track. That's no small contraption they've got there. Okay, next slide. Here's an example of what could happen when the road bed starts to sink. Notice, can't you imagine 5:30 a.m., you are the first conductor out on the road, and maybe you've had a drink or two or three the night before, and you're looking down the track, and that's what you see? Or maybe you're the one who doesn't drink, and you're wondering if someone had spiked your lemonade or something the night before, seeing something like that. Notice how wavy those tracks are. It's amazing in terms of sinkholes. If you have somebody, we don't have any comprehension of how many tons of dirt that were used to build the railroads in Michigan. The Grand Trunk between Grand Rapids and Grand Haven, a tremendous amount went in by Winnica, and a tremendous amount went in by Spring Lake. And the same problem with respect to, you know, they've got a road like road bed right there adjacent. This, we think, is this is Mono Lake, isn't it? This is by Mono Lake, where you have a lot of marshy areas there, too. Well, okay, you notice the third rail, in addition to the other, to the two rails that the wheels go on. Third rail, very large, very powerful. Conduit of 600 volts DC. Next slide. Well, that ribbon doesn't go by itself. It takes people, all kinds of people. And these are maintenance-away people. They may not be dressed as fancy as the conductors and the motormen and so on, but these, some of them are wearing top hats and so on, managerial types, you know, how to get the photograph. But this is the snowplow. This is also called... To the best of our knowledge, when these cars were all new, with this exception, they were all painted orange. Now, I don't know what color they were at the end, because Art contends, and I tend to agree with him, that these photographs look too dark for them to have been orange throughout their lifetime. They may have been maroon or something else in the 1920s or so on. But this is the Red Devil, very fascinating car with a nice big snowplow. They also had a flat car with a snowplow, which was called the Swamp Fox. And these people working for the interurban earned their keep. They had all kinds of problems with roadbed, and sinking roadbed was only one of the problems. Next slide. Yeah, right, because that's a lot of power when you're trying to ram snow, particularly in West Michigan, along the lake. Many times that was not enough. They had to get out and shovel. Notice they're all wearing rubber boots and so on, for very good reason. When you're dealing with a third rail, it could possibly be hot. It's appropriate to be somewhat insulated, not only from the weather, but from the juice. A lot of shoveling went on in these days. A lot of shoveling, because not only did they push the snow off the tracks, but they had the problem of what? That third rail. They had to have good electrical contact with that third rail. So that third rail had to be cleaned. And I give these people a lot of credit for all the hard work that they did. I'd like to know a little bit more about what the foreman told them. Maybe they turned off the juice on the third rail during this period of time they're using it, but my guess is, given workman's comp and everything else back then and concerns, that they were more interested in running the interurban on time than they were in... But this may have been fairly safe. I don't know. Okay, next slide. Interurbans may not seem that large, but this is a car that found out the power of an interurban. And to the best of my knowledge, this is one of the cars that tangled with one of the Grand Rapids, Grand Haven, and Muskegon interurbans and obviously lost. Next slide. I don't quite know how you tip an interurban. Whether an auto truck side swipes it, pushes it a little bit. I can understand how it gets off the trucks once it starts tipping. Something has to hit it really to tip it over. But occasionally they did tip, and that's one shot to get an idea of the undercarriage of these interurbans. Next slide. Here's one out in the countryside. Fortunately, these two were both express baggages, so the only people on board should have been working. Not to say that I don't care about those people who operated them. I do, but I'm thinking in terms of at least the wearing passengers on board, and the conductor and motorman should have had some idea that this might happen and what to do in case it did. Next slide. They would have to use a crane. They would have to use all kinds of equipment to get it off again. But they did. They got them back up again. Here's another one over, 107. Really slipping. You can see the broken third rail laying down on the side also, it looks like. Next slide. Now, these were telephone dispatched. I would have loved to have heard the telephone messages this day. Because somebody didn't get the message. And they hit head on. Now, all but one of the interurbans were wooden. Only one car was metal. All the others were wooden. Jeff, did anybody get killed in this one?
Two.
Okay, were they both motormen or?
Both motormen.
Okay, both motormen at the front end of these were killed. Next slide. This is one of the two. My which car number?
Car 4 on the right and the express on the left.
Okay.
4 was
reserved for back and through. Yeah. So, they could go up over 60 easily. They could get up over 60, I'm pretty sure of any. One of the things they can do is accelerate very rapidly. If you've ever been on a interurban, and by the way, interurbans still do run in the United States. Some of them are a little more elaborate, like the South Shore, which is one of the remaining. In fact, I think the only remaining one in the Great Lakes region. And if you get down to the Midwest Railroad Museum, they have some electrical track and run an interurban partly there. And they've got that very fast pickup. I don't know what the top speed was on these interurbans. I've got to talk to some people that know a little bit more about the engines and so on. But they could pick up speed very rapidly, and they could stop quite fast, too.
About
120
miles an hour.
And they did a nice job of repairing. They must have done some really nice work in Fruitport in terms of not only maintaining them, but putting them back together again. Next slide. This is a fascinating slide. There was one crossing with a steam locomotive railway. All the others were overpasses. They went over the Grand Trunk twice. I believe they went over the Pierre Marquette, though they also had a junction with the Pierre Marquette, but not a grade crossing. But when they got on to the, I think they were already on the Muskegon trolley tracks, but I'm not sure. This is a Grand Trunk train in Muskegon. The interurban conductor blew it. The rule was for the interurban to yield to the steam locomotive for two reasons. One, the steam locomotive track was there first. Secondly, who can stop faster? The interurban. Guess who didn't stop? The interurban. Right, well, they certainly did, and they pushed their competition off the road, too, in this case. Jack, how many people were killed here? Okay, well, we just got this photograph, when was it, a year ago, and I had a drawing of it that I had seen published in a book, and I asked Lawrence about it, and within a week he came up with a photograph of it, but I have not read the news account of this. And by the way, we're interested in news accounts concerning accidents and so on, as we would like to publish a more complete account than we already have. Okay, next slide. You've got to give the owners of the interurban credit. They went out for business in 1925, not a very popular year for the interurbans because it was their twilight era. The automobiles were taking over. But they went out after freight. Not only did they carry passengers, but they also carried freight. They carried freight from Grand Rapids to Grand Haven or from Grand Rapids to Muskegon and then via the steamers across the lake. And they had a number of their express baggage cars or express freight cars with these various advertising billboard type cars. And this is car number 107. Next slide. Yes. Okay, was that here in Grand Haven or? Okay, it was here in Grand Haven. Okay, so they even used them once as an ambulance. That's what you're telling us. So, okay, appreciate that piece of information. Okay, the focus is not very good on this one. But again, you can see the billboard advertising that they had a number of connections. They could go via the interurban to Grand Rapids, and from Grand Rapids they could go to Kalamazoo. From Kalamazoo they could go to Detroit, and so on. A number of interesting connections. There were three interurbans that operated out of Grand Rapids. The Grand Rapids, Grand Haven, Muskegon was one of them. The first one was the Grand Rapids, the Holland and then ultimately saw the tub line. The third one to come into Grand Rapids was the one that came in from Kalamazoo. And if you drive on the expressway to Kalamazoo, again, just look for the power lines are adjacent to the expressway, and that's the old right-of-way of that particular interurban.
Next. Because they have all of the different places besides,
you know, the Grand Rapids down here in Muskegon interurban only ran from Grand Rapids to Muskegon and Grand Haven. You would have to get on to another interurban and go to Kalamazoo. Then you would have to get on another interurban and go east. The problem with the interurbans is you had so many, you had to transfer so often. That was one of the weaknesses. It was fine for short trips, 50 miles and under, which is what you're dealing with going from here to Grand Rapids or going from Muskegon to Grand Rapids or vice versa. They were excellent for that.
Now, did any of these share tracks with railroads?
No, they did not share tracks with the steam railroads. They did share tracks with the streetcar lines, and they did have a junction with the Pierre Marquette because the Pierre Marquette provided them with coal for their powerhouse at the very beginning. So they had one junction where they could get freight cars, but I've never seen a photograph of a freight car, of a box car or anything like that on the interurban. I've seen pictures of coal cars, I've seen pictures of sand cars and others from the Pierre Marquette, but never a box car or something. Basically, they didn't have any factories that were on the line that I'm aware of. But we're still learning. So, okay. Here's another one. Notice I ship your freight. Save the highway for private use. Every time you may drive a truck or you may have a trucking firm, but I prefer to see the freight on the railroads for safety's sake, and particularly since I don't drive the same speed that the truckers drive, I'm concerned. But anyway, back in the 20s, they tried to advertise that. Obviously, it didn't work because they didn't make it. But anyway, they got a good try. Next slide. This is one of our favorite shots. Jack, who's in that photograph?
I just noticed
Edmund has got his head sticking out the window.
That's the only one
I know. Well, he makes that photograph a real classic. I mean, you got to look at that. I mean, he's ready to go, as well as the other two. I mean, the other two as well, but Ed really can set that up. Not only that, but notice what's on the cow catchers. The cow catchers being, and they really did meet cow catchers supposedly, because we shouldn't have ran into any cows with a nice fence and right away, etc. But notice a nice advertisement for the Berlin Fair. And like I said, this is car number 4, car number 5, and see they have Spring Lake and Mall Lake on many of the cars, so these cars did not have names, they had numbers. And that was it. Next slide. Okay, this is car number 6. Notice the headlight on the car. Those lights were quite bright, could be seen from quite a distance. Next slide. We're going to take it for a quick trip through some of the cars. Car number 8, next. There aren't that many of them, fortunately. I wanted to show all of them to you. Car number 10, next. Car number 4. How come we slip back to 4? Oh, it's gone. Over on our. Car number 15, there's two very proud people that operated car number 15. I don't blame them. Interesting occupation. Next slide. Okay, this is a slide showing the right-of-way. Again, as I said earlier, in the shape of a Y, coming out of Grand Rapids. And notice some of those interesting names. If someone were to ask me where the county line is, I've got some idea where that is, for obvious reasons. But Shackleton? I live near Shackleton. And if someone were to ask me where, I would not be able to identify it at all. So I've got to go to some plat map and see if I can find a Shackleton family on it, so I can pinpoint where Shackleton is coming out of Grand Rapids. And then as you go west, of course, you identify Berlin. You got Danforth, High Bridge is where the interurban went over the Grand Trunk. And then you have, can't read that next one, Bresnan, Streeter, Stiles, Coopersville, there's one I recognize. Callahan, I'm not sure where that one is yet. We've gone by it, I'm sure, but we've got to identify it. Denison, Morones, Conley, Unica, there's a familiar one. Hale, Johnson, Grand Haven Junction. Winds. Where is Winds? I've walked through Winds, but I can't identify where it is. Art and I walked through there. We walked by Brady also. Yeah, it was windy that day, but that's all I can say for it. And then Cemetery, and then going on into Spring Lake, Toll Bridge, and Grand Haven. We won't go through all the ones on the way up to Muskegon. But very, in many cases, these weren't much more than a grade crossing. Next slide.
Remember Mike?
Remember any ideas? I see many of these. The Mikes, this may have some relation to my wife's side of the family who come from the Fruitport, Spring Lake area. They spelled their name a little differently, though, but it was Mikes. Okay, this is the schedule. Eastbound trains, and you read them up, starting 5:30 in terms of departing, and then arriving 7:55. Okay, 5:30 departing Muskegon, and arriving Grand Rapids at 7:55. These took over an hour to go from Grand Rapids to Muskegon, or vice versa, and why? They made so many stops in between. They also sometimes unloaded some small freight, but usually the express motors handled those. If you got an express car, or if you got a special excursion car, you could make a lot faster time than this. Okay, next slide. Well, everything has to end sometime, and one of the things that happens is the cars get taken away. Now this car isn't being taken away, to the best of our knowledge, it is being delivered. The St. Louis car is the only steel car on the line. And this is a photograph of it as it was either being outshipped from the St. Louis Car Company or as it arrived. My guess is it's outshipped because I think that's the St. Louis Car Company 1122 number down there, which is, they took photographs of everything that went out of their shop. So I would imagine this was taken when it was up and ready to come to the Fruitport area. Next slide. This is a shot of what happened to it when it went to the east side of the state after it was abandoned here. It became part of the Detroit system. And you can see the Detroit sign on the front. I think it says Detroit on the front. This is the only steel car in the group. Next slide. The steel car and the wooden cars were not the last to run. The last scheduled run was April the 18th or 19th of 1928. I keep getting the date mixed up by a day or two because April 19 really sticks in my mind for anyone that's interested in American history and spent time in the Massachusetts area, you know about Haiti State and so on. So I'm not quite sure when the last interurban ran. I think it was either April 18 or 1928. That was the last scheduled run. Now, on that last scheduled run, the Highway Commission was aboard because they were going to what? Purchase Remembrance Road for part of US 16. They're going to purchase part of the interurban from Nunica to Fruitport again.